10 pounds, and he tells about the buckets, and so on and so forth, and this is the best source. All right, now how to get it and everything. And then he says, I load the buckets up with about 40, 60 pounds, depending on the material density. And another option is to bolt a PVC cap on the bottom of the bucket that will hold the bottom of your pole plate when you use water, rocks, or snow in the wintertime. And then he goes on and tells you about the rice. So that's the story, Dick. Plastic poles with wires hanging on them, over.
Whether the pole is made out of fiberglass, bamboo, or aluminum or steel, almost doesn't matter. It's got almost the exact same wind load, and when the wind blows more than 10 miles an hour, the wind load on these things is going to tend to blow them over. And he looks like he's at a beachfront. And when you're at a beachfront, you almost always have wind. So without guying these things with polypropylene rope, I'm a little skeptical if this is a practical idea. I like the idea that you can pick up a pole and rotate it and therefore steer your Yagi in some other direction. That's real Armstrong rotation if ever there was. And on the assumption that the poles are not super expensive, I would much rather see him set up a bunch of poles in a bunch of directions so he can electronically steer the antenna by choosing which driven element he feeds and so on, and detuning the others by various means. So there's other ways he can steer the antenna other than physically moving the elements on the ground. But a 35-foot-high pole, I don't care if it's fiberglass, and I don't care if it's telescoping, that's a lot of wind load for this little bucket on the bottom to hold it up. It looks to me like at a beachfront with the wind blowing, I think that's going to blow over. Back to you for comments on that, Mel, and then go to the next person that's giving you a email, K2KEY, with the mailbag, K2RIW.
Okay, yeah, Roger, I guess he just puts it up there, you know, it's a real temporary operation, maybe a day is calm. Not always, the wind is not always blowing down the beach, that's down there a lot of times, in the summertime it gets pretty hot and sticky and not much of a breeze blowing. So I guess possibly he gets the same situation, a real temporary setup, as he explains. And I'm sure, how long are you going to be down there? You know, you're running on battery and all. You know, the battery is not going to last many hours. So time you're down there, I guess, is sufficient for him to at least make some contact, especially if he's running a QRP rig, give him a little bit more of an effect, being that he's got a little better antenna system than just some piece of, you know, one of these wonder antennas that I wonder sometimes how they work, because, you know, they sell a lot of these little short zips that supposedly for QRP, but QRP does not mean, I told a lot of people that you have to use a QRP antenna. You can use a very sufficient array of antenna and still be QRP. All right, let me take another one. Let me drop. All right, let's see. Right. What about this poor fellow here? Oh, I bought last year a remote control antenna tuner. And I installed it at the feed point of the vertical antenna in my backyard. Works pretty good most of the time. Occasionally, something opens. And I don't know what's going on. Seems that it only happens on particular bands. What is going on that every so often the tuner stops working on particular bands? Oh, well, I guess I have an idea what's going on there, but what do you think, Dick?
You did say remote tuner at the antenna and automatic tuner. And the way the automatic tuners work, in many cases, there's something like a Pi network. It could be an L network. It could be an L Pi. There's various ways you can set up a tuner, an impedance matching device. And the way the automatic antenna tuners work is they look at the reflected signal from the antenna, and there's some signal reflecting from the antenna because the antenna, by definition, has some amount of standing wave ratio. Otherwise, you wouldn't be using the tuner. And the tuner has to measure the magnitude of the reflected signal and its phase angle. And there's the problem. Because the automatic tuner looks at that reflected signal and says, aha, I recognize that. Its microprocessor, if it's programmed correctly, says, I recognize that that particular magnitude of reflected signal and that particular phase angle, and therefore I should set C1 to this value and C2 to that value. And it goes there and double-checks the measurement and says, aha, I've arrived. Well, occasionally at certain phase angles and certain magnitudes, the phase measuring device, it gets it wrong. Maybe it makes a 180-degree flip. I'm not quite sure what. But a number of people with automatic antenna tuners on certain bands or a certain section of the band, the antenna tuner goes crazy, never comes up with a solution, or comes up with a wrong solution. So automatic antenna tuners, what I'm hearing is that they work like a charm 95% of the time, but maybe 5% of the time they get hung up, and you've got to do some kind of a manual override to get it out of the hang-up. I wonder if you've heard stories along those lines, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Well, what happens a lot of times with these automatic tuners, you know, you got a control line, you got to feed power and everything up to them. And there's been a number of people that have complained to the manufacturers of these automatic tuners that this seems to be a problem on certain bands, that the tuners just go wacky. They go just go back into reset. They're good in the receive position, working excellent. At low power, they'll show a very nice match. And sometimes you go to higher power, still way below what they are rated to handle, but they go crazy. And the only thing you can account for it, I think, and I believe the manufacturers, a few of them have suggested, is that RF is getting into the control line of the for the automatic tuner and installing ferrite chokes, you know, winding these chokes that they sell, you know, putting like a number of turns, like 10 turns through the choke, seems to help Dick. What do you think of that, Pure? Over.
Yeah, there's something a little funny going on here. The antenna tuner is made to take the RF and properly impedance match it. And yet we're telling ourselves that the antenna tuner is having trouble tolerating the RF when it's on the control lines, which suggests that the control lines don't have enough RF bypassing right at the electronics itself. It suggests that the manufacturer cut some corners and said that you have to use a shielded cable and properly bypassed cable and inductively coupled cable with these chokes in order to protect the circuitry because we didn't do it. We, the manufacturer. That's what it sounds like. The whole idea of an antenna tuner is to take full transmitter power and properly handle it. And the fact that in the vicinity of that antenna transmitter, the antenna tuner can't tolerate its the RF that's going through it when some of it sneaks through the control lines. It doesn't bode well for good design practices. Now, I still think that the phase error is one of the explanations for why these things sometimes go crazy. It took quite a period of time before Hewlett-Packard came up with techniques with a synchronous demodulator, synchronous rectifier technique, in order to be able to measure phase angle at RF frequencies. Until the late 60s, measuring phase angle was a very difficult thing to do. Nowadays, we take it for granted because every self-respecting... Let me drop... Eric recognized a little bit low in audio and a little bit low in RF, but we'll get turned over to you in a second. Every self-respecting vector network analyzer these days has no trouble measuring phase, but 20 or 30 years ago, that was a difficult thing. So maybe you've got some experience with automatic antenna tuners, Eric, and maybe you've got a better explanation for what's going on when they sometimes go into a search mode and never find a good solution. KE2EJ, our broadcast engineer, K2RIW. Go right ahead, Eric.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Now, I've fixed a number of them. There's a couple different kinds. There's the kinds with the motorized capacitor and bunch of relays, click capacitors and inductance in and out. But the thing that I find common to all of them, and most of them are microprocessor controlled, and analyzing a couple of them, the software wants to put the last couple of frequency stores in memory. And what it tries to do is, if it senses that you're operating in that band, that particular frequency, or in that range, it'll try and recall. And what I've noticed on a couple of brands is that the software is not well written, and they, in essence, have poor memory management, where they literally overwrite themselves. And when that happens, they just kind of get lost and go into a forever search mode. And when you tune outside of that range, where it knows it has to make a whole new measurement because it's an area in which it won't, because they say, you know, if you're only moving 5 kilohertz to 10 kilohertz, there's no need to retune. So once you go outside that, we'll reset, retune, reload, make a new decision, and then tune up. But I've also seen them with the relays that go bad, too.
When you find these errors of software errors and rewriting and whatever, what, in your opinion, is the solution, Eric? On the ones that you've repaired, what did you have to change to get it out of these difficulties? Over to you, Eric.
Well, the ones with the software bugs, you're kind of stuck because they use mass programmable microprocessors, especially the old ones, meaning you can't modify the software, you can't change it. If you really have, if you've got the stamina and you don't mind doing a lot of work, you can replace the microprocessor with a similar one and do your own programming. That's one solution. The ones with the relays that get stuck, they're easy to fix. You just replace the relays, or what I like to do is take a head demagnetizer and demagnetize these little sink and rear relays that hang up on you.
That's a brand new one on me. So in other words, I think you're saying these reed relays occasionally acquire permanent magnetization, even though they're not supposed to. Therefore, they get stuck in a closed mode. Is that what you're saying, Eric? Go ahead.
Now, I don't know if you've ever noticed, but a lot of the Japanese reed relays, after X number of cycles, they begin to become slightly magnetized. So sometimes they don't like to open, or they open slightly. You can actually see it on an ohmmeter. You'll see sometimes it's perfectly, you know, when it's active, it makes a perfect zero ohm contact. And then when you release it, it goes to like 50 ohms, 100 ohms, 200 ohms. And then in time, it becomes an open, especially as they age. It ain't supposed to happen, but it is magnetic material, and it does retain sometimes. So, and I've seen that a lot in video gear. We whack them, and, you know, the problem goes away until the problem comes back. You can replace them, and you get a longer period of time before the problem comes back. But the problem comes back, if you replace it with the same thing. If you put in a clear penta or some good old American-made stuff, you don't get the problem at all.
When it comes to transmit-receive relays on a transceiver that we use, some of them are using diodes, some of them are using FETs, and some of them use electromechanical old-fashioned relays. Have any of the modern rigs used reed relays as a transmit-receive function? Some people are running into problems where when they go from transmit back to receive and vice versa, they're not getting good operation of the transmit-receive relay. So are any of the rigs making those out of reed relays, and maybe these inexpensive Japanese reed relays, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Now, quite honestly, Dick, you're probably better off asking Hal for the answer to that question, because I don't really get to see too much of stuff. The ones that I've worked on, they're all diode switching, so they avoid the mechanical problem.
Frank.
Who's that person? Give me your call letters and name.
Sorry, Dick, this is Gary, KI6IJI. I got an answer of what kind of a press we're running at the paper, It's a DGM. DGM web. And we do tabs too, but we do mostly newspaper and commercial work. I'll let you get back to your discussion. This is KI6IJI, 73s, and after yours, I will be disconnected.
I sense, Gary, that you're out of the area. I'm probably coming through EchoLink or IRLP. And go a little bit slower and repeat your message because I missed something. I'm not quite sure what the subject matter is. I missed a couple of the early words, and it's not your fault, it's mine. So go right ahead and repeat your message, Gary. KI6, India, Juliet, India, K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Thank you, Dick. This is KI6IJI. You asked me what kind of press that I worked on at the Auburn Journal newspaper. And I wrote it down when I got home, and I haven't been able to talk to you about the name of the press. It's a GM, Delta George Mike Web Press. Delta George Mike Web Press. And we do regular newspapers, we do perfect fees, and all for different names and different accounts. And I wanted to tell you that one night when you were having your on tech topics. So I was disconnecting after I hear you say 73. Have a nice evening over there, and it's 80 degrees in California. Back to you, K2RW, KI6JI. Thank you very much.
Now it makes more sense, Gary. You're answering a question from 1 or 2 weeks ago. And I thought you're giving us a comment on the subject that's on the floor right now when you're telling us about what kind of press was being used. Thank you for the information. And don't have to disconnect, but that's your choice. Alrighty. Let's see now. We've gone down the list. Andy's questioned. Jerry didn't have a question. Gary. The first Gary. One more call. Let's see if Gary is there. Oh, no. We're still... I'm getting back on board here.
Mailbag.
We're still on the mailbag, exactly. Thank goodness somebody reminded me. Mel, maybe you've got one more you want to handle. K2KEY, K2RIW, losing it.
Thank you very much, guys. This is KI6IJI, California, disconnecting.
Okay, very good. All right, yeah, well, that's right, we're still on the mailbag. Okay, I'm going to make a trip this summer, here the gentleman says, to Australia. Oh, nice. They use 220 volts there, and let's see, my ham gear is 110 volts. Do you know if Australians also use 60 hertz for their AC mains? Somebody says that they're using 50 hertz. Okay, I'll get a converter that'll convert 220 to 110. What happens about the power supply when it sees 50 hertz? Would that be a problem? Okay, what happens to the power supply, Dick, when you put 50 hertz into a 60 hertz power supply? Go ahead.
That depends. There's no simple answer on that one. Back in the early 70s, I worked for a division of Airborne Instruments Laboratory that was building spectrum analyzers. The AIL 707 and 727 were the model numbers of the spectrum analyzers. And yes, that number was chosen to be identical to a popular airplane at the time, so people could easily remember it. And we were buying a transformer from a respected company in New Jersey, a main power transformer, which was rated to operate on 110 and 220, 115 and 230, let's say. It had two different taps on the primary, and the manufacturer absolutely guaranteed that it would run on 50 or 60 hertz. He guaranteed that. However, we started getting a lot of returns from Japan because people were complaining about the fact the power supply made a loud humming noise, and it ran hot. Turns out he had bought a lot of steel that's used for the EI laminations for the main power transformer, which was lower in magnetic properties. Therefore, I should tell you first that as you go lower in frequency, from 60 hertz down to 50 hertz, the amount of magnetization of the core of the transformer, because of the primary winding, as you go lower in frequency, you're asking the core to produce a larger amount of magnetic field. And if the particular iron you're using is a little bit lower in quality on this particular production run, and the core saturates, all hell breaks loose. So those cores probably would have worked great at 55 hertz and above, but down at 50 hertz, which is the Japanese frequency for that particular section of Japan, the transformers really didn't like it. Loud hum, decreased voltage output, hot transformers, and...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
And the customer was afraid to use the equipment for fear that further damage would take place. And we had to replace those transformers to fix the problem with a higher quality one, ones where the iron was of higher quality. So if there's a real iron transformer involved, when you go from 60 hertz to 50 hertz, go slow. Worry about these details. If it is a switching type of power supply, and the manufacturer has really a reputable guy, and he says it'll work on anything from 40 hertz to 400 hertz, and anything from 90 volts to 240 volts. I mean, there are kinds of universal power supplies, switching type power supplies, that can handle this. But if there's a real iron transformer involved, you've got to be concerned, is my experience, Mel. I wonder if you run into things like that. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, no doubt. That's exactly what happens. As you go in lower frequency, and even a well-designed transformer will tend to start to run a little bit on a hotter side. So if it's a power supply that has a power transformer in it, how much hotter will it run will be depend on the material that is used. Getting a transformer that will take you from 220 down to 110 usually is a transformer that is designed, I believe, has a pretty wide design, because that's what the figuring that you're going to do with it for traveling purposes, that they sell those for people that are, you know, taking trips to areas where they're going from, say, 220. They got to get their equipment back down to 110. I have to have one of them, but, you know, it's just the use of my electric razor and everything like that. But it specifically got the polarized plug on it, you know, the whole bit and everything. It was meant for foreign use. But a regular conventional power supply, let me let it drop and I'll say something about frequency.
Okay, sure, sir.
Okay, get to you. 1 second, Eric. When you get even a step-down transformer, it does not change over the frequency. In other words, if it's 220, 50 hertz coming in, and it drops it down to 110, it'll still be 50 hertz. Go over to you, Eric. Go ahead, take it.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention one caveat with those travel transformers and the bigger ones, because we do a lot of shooting in Europe and in Japan. What you might think is really a transformer is really not. Really a backwards auto transformer. And that's why the plugs are polarized. You've got to be real careful about those things when you're hooking stuff up. You can actually put 200 volts on your chassis if you're not careful. But and because they're auto transformers, they really, you know, they use crappy metal. They really don't care that much about the magnetic field being, you know, the core being a high quality, because they're not using the magnetic core to transfer energy. Back to you, Dick. K2RW, K2J.
Many of the ham transmitters we use are capable of 100 watts output, and they probably draw 200, 250 watts from the line while doing that. So what talking about a moderate amount of power to run a ham radio rig if it's not a QRP rig. QRP, by the way, is the three-letter abbreviation for people who run less than 5 watts. The newer people may not know that. And as a whole, just like some people like fishing with very light line because they like the sport, there are hams that like using very low power, and they like that extra challenge. And they're the QRP people. And the QRO is when you go up in power, and QRP is when you go down. Three-letter abbreviations. There's a whole lot of three-letter abbreviations beginning with Q, which were ways of sending compact information back in the days of Morse code being very popular with ham radio. So you can buy a kind of small travel box, a box for travelers, which is one handful of electronics, and it's rated for numbers like 250 and 300 watts. It's rated to run things, and maybe there's even a version that goes to 1,000 watts. It will run an electronic hair dryer. Electronic hair dryer, and many of them draw a little bit over 1,000 watts. So you can buy this little box, which will take 240 volts, 50 hertz power, cut it down to 115 volts to run your particular hair dryer. That's the good news. Some of these are run by a switching regulator type. Some of them are fairly inexpensive chunk of electronics. And the waveform that comes out of there is a very distorted waveform. Your hair dryer can tolerate very distorted waveforms. Your ham rig and its power supply maybe cannot. So be a little bit careful if you buy one of these things that's a handful of electronics rated for 1,000 watts, and it's a universal converter for foreign power use. I worry about
repeater. Timeout. Repeater. Timeout. Cancel.
I worry about a person picking up one of those and thinking he's going to run his 100-watt rig with it. Better go slow and do a lot more research as to what it's rated for, what kind of a waveform comes out of it. Probably the data sheet that comes with it is not going to tell you. You're going to have to run some tests, or you're going to have to do a good-sized web search, or find somebody who's run into your exact same situation. So I'm guaranteed that there is some technical expert at ARRL headquarters in Newington, Connecticut, where hams are traveling all the time with all kinds of electronics. There's got to be an expert up there like Zach Lau, among others, W1VT, is his latest call letters, who can answer questions like this. If I buy this brand of power converter, and I'm using it with this brand of transmitter, and I'm about to go to a country that uses 240 volts and 50 hertz, is that a compatible combination, even though I've got the right mechanical prongs that I can put on this thing so I can plug it into the wall? That's only half the problem. Is the voltage and the waveform going to be right, and will your rig tolerate it without damage to any of the electronics involved? K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
This is K2CQM.
Very noisy station who said he wanted to say hello. Who is that?
Sorry about that. George, K2CQM.
K2CQM, George. Okay, George, thank you very much. I don't remember now where you and I talked last. It's been a while. Mel, K2KEY, go right ahead.
Okay, very good. Sounds like a way of doing it is, yeah, check with the ARL. They may have a list, some kind of cross-referencing that maybe can give you a idea of which unit to purchase before you go. That will be the best for your situation. And looks like Eric said that, yeah, I guess most of them are based on an auto transformer principle going from 220 to 110. Whether there's ones that have complete isolation, maybe a little too heavy, I don't know. I have no idea. I guess it depends on what kind of power you're going to drag out there. I know they're available from, say, small ones from like 50 watts into the hundreds of watts. All right, should we try one more, Dick?
Go right ahead, Mel.
Okay, here's one. Let's see. I am going to stay with my grandmother during the summertime, and she lives in an apartment. And I got permission to put up an antenna. But my problem is, I got to bring the coax down, and I got to put it through the window, and I got to figure a way to be able to close the window at the same time to keep the heat out while we have the air conditioning on, and also how to secure the window because it's going to be slightly open to for the coax. What would you suggest? Is any ideas to what to do in this situation for a temporary setup? Well, there's several, but what would you suggest, Dick?
The guy I know who has solved that problem the most number of times is K2KEY. Tell us how you solved it, Mel.
Oh, I haven't solved it many times. There are a few times I had similar situations. I got a piece of wood, basically, like a piece of lumber in fact, if you want a good security along to go with it, I got a piece of 2x4, cut it to the width of the window, drilled a hole through it, passed the coax through it, lowered the window down, you know, on the 2x4, and then I put a piece of wood up at the top of the sash, making it so that, you know, it can't be forced open easily from the outside. That's the simplest way because it's the cheapest way. It's not going to be a permanent situation. But this way it closes down, gives you security, and at the same time, you know, like I say, you won't let the bugs in and the heat in the summertime, Dick. Over.
To Leo, Dick.
Go ahead. I see how you solved it, Rich.
Okay, well, I can just tell you that what Mel said works very well, and if the guy doesn't want to actually cut the wood and make it himself, that type of product is available in metal from MFJ. I think it's under $100, I'm pretty sure, with bulkhead connectors and everything already mounted.
That sounds like a pretty nice solution. Wonder if you've seen anything like that, Mel.
Yeah, that's been around for a while. There's a number of manufacturers like that. But this is a temporary. That's what he stressed. It's only going to be for a few weeks while he stays with his grandmother. So I don't think a young person should go out and have to spend like $100 for something at, with multi-connectors and all when he's just going to have a temporary antenna or cable and all. Like I said, I'm giving him the real cheap way out. Just get a piece of scrap 2x4 wide enough, drill a hole in it, push the cable through, push the window down on it, you know, and the sash down on it, block off the top for the weight so that window can't be, forced open, and be done with it, Dick, rather than putting money into something that's most likely maybe you'll never use again or long time off. Over.
WS2N. Go ahead, Paul. Let's see how you solve the problem.
Yeah, you know what I like? The insulation, that heavy-duty foam rubber insulation that you can get from anywhere, Home Depot, Lowell's, that you would use for, an air conditioner. You know, when you put these air conditioners in the window, you could put an insulation, on the sides or on the top, then you close the window onto it, and then do a similar type of thing. Well, in your own home, you would take maybe a couple of screws or something. You could actually tighten your window down that way. But, somebody else's house, your grandmother's house, you'd do exactly what Mel did. You put the wood, from the top of the window to the top of the very top of the window. You just measure exactly that distance, and you push a piece of wood in to hold that closed. But you put your coax through, put this heavy duty insulation that they use for the air conditioners, the length of the window, close the window on top of that, as tight as you want, right up to the coax, crushing the insulation and coax together. And then you take a measurement for your piece of wood, cut that, and you're gonna be good to go for the whole summer. However long he's going to be there. Back to you, Dick.
There are kinds of foam, rigid foam, the foam insulation that you can buy at Home Depot, which has extremely good R values. It's very easy to cut up with a Stanley knife or even a larger knife, and you can saw it in all kinds of shapes. So to cut out a chunk of foam, which has a slot where the coax goes through, you push the coax down into that slot, and then you take another piece of foam to fill up the rest of that slot that you cut carefully, and that you close into the window. With a little bit of skill, you don't even have to have a feed-through connector like you would have to have with a piece of 2x4. Although you could also make the slotted arrangement with a 2x4. So foam, 2x4, there's lots of ways that a crafty guy can build a thing that either uses a connector on the feed-through or feeds the coax through it exactly with no connectors, because there's two pieces to it that you disassemble and reassemble. So there's lots of ways of doing it, of keeping out the weather and yet allowing the coax to flow through, as long as the window doesn't have to close all the way. Yes, I will admit that now if the window had some kind of a locking mechanism for security so that people from the outside on the fire escape can't get in, I'll admit that's a little bit more difficult. You may have to drill a hole to put a screw through, or a pin, if you know what I mean. And when it comes to the security situation, I guess there's also a way by which you could make a skilled piece of wood that jams into the upper portion of the window so that it can no longer be opened any further than the amount of opening you've got for that that feed-through device. Back to you, Mel, for any other comments on this one. K2KEY, K2RIW.
That's why I suggested it. That's exactly what you do. You put the 2x4 across. You drill a hole through the 2x4, push the cable through, move the window down snugly onto the 2x4, get another piece, stick it from the top of the sash of the window up to the top of the frame, and jam it in there, and it is snug. That's it. That'll lock your window down that it can't possibly be lifted from the outside, and at the same time won't crush your cable, and it's cheap. You can pick up a shorter for the width of the window, a piece of scrap, or you need a couple of pieces of scrap, piece of wood. I don't have to really maybe make any trip to the hardware places or anything. You may find those couple of pieces of wood in the street. Works real well. Did that many times, and like I say, after you finish with it, it's no big deal to discard that over.
And it don't have to be a 2x4 either, right? No, you know, I use furring strips. It's a little thinner. You don't need this big thick thing.
Okay, there's lots of ways you can do that. Also, when you do put that jamming device on the top of the window so it can't be opened from the outside, although it's a very rare thing that you need it, I do recommend that you tell everybody in the house that this extra jamming device is there. In the case of a fire, where you've got to get out of that window onto the fire escape in a panic mode, you want all the people in the house to know that they got to remove that jamming device. If they get up to that window, can't open it, that's the only egress they've got at that particular period of time, that could be life-threatening. It's a rare situation, but we amateurs, we plan for the worst-case situation, we think ahead, and that's something to worry about. You think we should stop here or take one more? It's your choice, Mel. K2RIW over to K2KEY.
Comment, Dick? Yeah, I never thought of that. WS2N.
Yeah, go ahead. Good about that one, Paul. And John, go ahead with your comment.
Just remind them, if they use the piece of wood as a wedge for that lower sash, they still have to use a little metal bracket for the upper sash if it's a double hung window, because they could just pull that down and remove it. So, just a note.
Yes, there's the other question.
Go ahead, Wesley.
Yeah, I would like to ask the audience if anybody has knowledge what's going on with the 73 kilohertz, 136 kilohertz, and 160 to 190 kilohertz bands, the situation with the FCC. As far as I know, a number of stations from Region 2, WD2XDW, was working on it. There was WD2XES, and there was also, I'm looking for the WD2XJ, XGJ, and it looks like I'm kind of confused in this area. The Russo company made by ham radio amateurs, Amstrad or something like that, and they have got in 2004 the license for the experimental use of extra low frequency and very low frequencies. That was on the frequency 136 kilohertz. But yeah, but just would like to find out whether I could be safe since I acquired some of the equipment, and me, John, we may experiment with very low frequency. We don't want to violate the rules of FCC. Back to you.
Yeah, let's see if we have anyone on frequency who knows the current rules on these rather low frequencies, like 136 kilohertz, and the use of those for ham radio, maybe with a special temporary authority. I'm not quite sure what's required. It may require an extra license. Maybe it doesn't. Maybe it's even license free as long as you're low enough in power output and low enough in antenna gain. Not very many of us have got to worry about having too much antenna gain at a frequency that low where the wavelengths are so long. So if anyone on frequency has some further information on those frequencies for ham radio use, give me your call letters right now. K2RIW on the TechNet.
W2JPW. Yes, I know something about it, Ben.
WJ2GW. It's a tongue twister. Go right ahead, sir.
W2Juliet, Papa Whiskey. You know me, Dick. I haven't been on in a while, but I've called in lots of times. Lou is the name. Yes, I know about this. I just bought the book a while back from the ARRL. It's an RSGB publication. And it's called, I forgot the name, but I have it upstairs. It's all about this. I have to drop, I guess, do I? Okay, I guess that'll be it. I don't know the rules on this repeater anymore. Am I all right?
Sorry, I didn't recognize you right away, Lou. As long as you wait for all four beeps and really reset everything, no problem. Go ahead.
Okay, I don't know how long I have to transmit for. You used to turn the timer off, but you don't anymore. So anyway, let's take each frequency at a time. 136 kilohertz is legal in Australia. They have they operate in Australia and in some European countries, most of them, I think. It's not authorized here. The league applied for it, but the power industry put the nix on it, and the FCC refused permission for U.S. amateurs to operate on 136 kilohertz. Now, 600 meters is in the offing. The last month's QSD had an article about it, and also the league sent out a letter on their spectrum defense talking about 600 kilohertz, so 600 meters rather, 500 kilohertz, 600 meter band, the old marine telegraph frequency. The distress frequency is now open for grabs, so to speak. Okay, got that done. It's open for grabs, and a lot of jurisdictions in South America and elsewhere in the world have shown interest in letting amateur radio onto these frequencies. It may be not exactly on that frequency. It might be a little lower. We don't know yet. But the league told me when I called them about it that they're pushing hard for it. They're going to do everything they can to secure amateur secondary, it would be secondary, not the primary allocation on that particular frequency. So we may get 600 meters, but 136 kilohertz is out. Now 160 to 190. 90 is the same as it always was. 1 watt with a 50-foot antenna, no more than that. You can do that anytime you want. That's where the loafers hang out. It does work. Years ago, I heard, I think it was Ken Cornell or somebody down in Colts Neck. I could hear him up here on my old Navy long-wave receiver without any trouble. No, it does. And there was another station many years ago in the 80s in one of the towns around here. I could hear him, too. So it does work. I don't know how you... The radiation efficiency is pretty awful. If you have a lot of trees around it, with the Marconi with 10,000 volts on it, it doesn't work very well either. Back to you, Dick, W2JPW, bye.
Thank you, Lou. Good information. Now, you did say that there is a book that ARRL has that Wesley could buy. Is that a British or an American book? What's the title? How many dollars? So, in other words, is there a book that tells us the latest information on this, to your knowledge, Lou? Or is the best way for Wesley to get that knowledge is to get it by word of mouth by making a phone call to the league? But if there is a book, what's the name of the book and roughly how many dollars? W2JPW, K2RIW and the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, K2RIW and TechNet, W2JPW. Let me go upstairs and get the book, and I'll tell you everything about it. It's an RSGB publication, but the league sells it. Just QRX, I'll be right back.
Take your time, and just break in when you come back with the book. One other thing that I want to briefly go through, and that is a discussion that Len, K2IVX, and I had during the week. And there's a lot of misunderstanding in this one, so I think it's worth going through. Many a time we amateurs want to go from a situation where we're using one single antenna and we want to add a second antenna on the exact same band. Maybe you want to stack a second Yagi above the one you're using, and in theory you're going to get 3 dB more gain. Maybe you've got a long wire and you want to add a second one. Maybe you've got a dipole and you want to add a second one with a separate feed line. And as long as you're using a power divider that is rated for that frequency range, an equally power device, and after the power division, you have an equal length of cable to the two antennas, and the two antennas are stacked correctly. In other words, if you're stacking two Yagis vertically because you want a little bit more gain, you want to make sure that one Yagi is not upside down compared to the... in other words, for symmetry of the way you lace the cabling, it's very easy to have the upper antenna upside down, the lower antenna right side up, and that way you bring the cables together. Well, you forget about the fact that when you put the upper antenna upside down, you've made a 180-degree phase shift. And when you combine those two signals in that manner, when they're out of phase, you'll have a null on the horizon. You'll have a peak above the horizon and a peak below the horizon. You don't want to do that. So equal length of cable, worry about getting things inverted. And with a power divider, no sweat. However, the question that came up is, what happens if I combine the two feed lines with nothing but a T-connector? And I run that back to the transmitter. The T-connector is putting your two 50-ohm antennas, we'll say, in parallel. Therefore, in the middle of that T-connector, you've got a 25-ohm impedance. And yes, on a 50-ohm transmission line that goes from the T-connector all the way back to the shack, you are running a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. What happens? How does the signal divide? How does the signal feed back and forth between the two antennas? And there's at least two answers to this, but they both teach something very valuable. Let me drop in and give you that information.
I'm back, Lou.
Go ahead, Lou. What's the name of the book and how many dollars? You got it, Lou.
Okay, K2RW and the TechNet W2JPW. The name of the book is LF Today, A Guide to Success on 136 and 500 kilohertz by Mike Dennison, D-E-N-N-I-S-O-N, the G3XDV, George 3 X-ray Delta Victor. And Jim Moritz, M-O-R-I-T-Z, M-0-B-M-U, M-0-B-M-U. I guess that's a new British call. It's an excellent book. I haven't read it all, but I've looked through some of the chapters and read some of it, and they'll tell you anything you want to know about them. There's some very sophisticated techniques for weak signal work on these impossibly low frequency. But I will tell you the discouraging thing is when you go through the, of course you can find these equations in other books as well. When you go through the equations calculating the radiation resistance, it's downright depressing. I checked out these equations in an old book from the British Admiralty on 600 meter transmitters that they, this book was written in 1930, and they used the same equation back then as they do now, and the radiation resistance is negligible on these frequencies unless you have a big antenna. The only guys who are going to make out on these bands are, you know, really with good signal is somebody with a 10-acre estate and 200-foot towers that they can put on a three-wire flat top and a 100-foot down lead on it and a bunch of counterpoises. On a lot like I've got, I got pretty discouraged pretty quickly. Back to you, Dick. Go ahead.
Coming. Yeah, let me ask you a couple of questions on this one, Lou. First of all, I'm assuming this is a $20 book being sold by ARRL. And you did say it on the title. It talks about 136 hertz and some of the, and one of those other frequencies. Does it also discuss the all of the other frequencies, the other low frequencies? But here's the main thing I wanted to ask you. When I do a calculation for the resistive component of the impedance that's too of the antenna that's too small, I might come up with a number like 1.5 ohms. That's the resistive component and a great big reactive component. Am I using the right kind of a shunt inductor or whatever? I can get rid of the reactive component. The fact that the resistive component is 1.5 ohms is not a showstopper. Many of the power transistors in the radio world that we drive have an input impedance of 1.5 ohms. So as long as you can impedance match down to 1.5 ohms, at least I can get the majority of the power out of my transmitter into that antenna. Now, how much of that's going to couple into the local ground and how much is going to radiate into space, that's another factor. But the fact that the radiation resistance, the resistive component, is a low number, in my opinion, is not a showstopper. Have I got that wrong, Lou? W2JPW, K2RIW?
No, you got it right. They are radiating some power because they've sent signals around the world on these frequencies. But it ain't easy. I'm not so worried about the impedance matching. It's how much power is actually being radiated, and they have another problem with Marconi. I've tried this myself. I know that you get all that voltage out there. What do you do when it rains? So you got a 60-foot vertical. And you got 10,000 volts of RF on it, and you got it mounted on an insulator, and the insulator gets all wet. Where does all that RF go? You have to have dry weather to run it. And also, they say right in this book that if you've got a lot of trees around, that with a an antenna with these enormous voltages on it, that the trees act like a leaky dielectric and absorb it all. Go ahead, Dick.
Each time I pass it over to you, Lou, sometimes you forget to wait for all four beeps. And lucky for you, you didn't time out the machine. Water in the air doesn't change the dielectric constant of the air. That's a not very well-known factor. In other words, the air is good for 30,000 volts per centimeter. And whether it's dry air, you know, high moisture air or dry air, you get the exact same number. To keep the water off an insulator, you just have to put some kind of a top hat over the insulator so the water drips down around the insulator and not on the insulator itself. And if the insulator is long enough, and if the water was pure enough, the water wouldn't be a conductor. So there are ways of keeping the water off the insulator. Yes, the trees are going to be an absorber of these frequencies. Not a really big one. I don't think tree absorption is anywhere near as bad as people expect. When it comes to a frequency like 432 and 1296, and the leaves are wet, yes, those trees are quite anechoic. They suck up the RF energy, convert it into heat. but the dimensions of the leaves, the dimensions of the branches of that tree are very small compared to the wavelengths you're talking about. So I don't think they've got very much capability of absorbing substantial amounts of that energy. So as I see it, whether or not the radiation efficiency of what of the power that gets into the antenna, how much of it's radiated into space, that's something to be mildly concerned about. But when it comes to matching a low impedance, I don't think that's much of a problem. I don't think we should allow that to make us lose a whole lot of sleep. Do I have that one wrong, Lou? W2JPW, wait for all four beeps, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, thanks. Yeah, I'm not too savvy with this repeater setup that we have now. Yeah, you're right. Of course, you're right. You know more about this stuff than I do. But I never knew that trees would affect these low frequencies. But what this book claims is if you have a high current antenna like a loop, trees will have no effect hardly at all on it. But when you've got these huge voltages, that's what they're saying, that it affects it. Now, I have no experience at these frequencies with anything except playing around in a room with high voltages and stuff and seeing how easily it leaks off a piece of wire, but, you know, with a big loading coil and so forth, or lighting up light bulbs and things like that. But, so it's news to me. I have no experience with it in an experimental fashion whatsoever. The book costs about $26, Dick, and ARRL has it in stock, but it is an RSDB publication, as I said. Back to you. Go ahead.
Right now, I'm Googling the word Marconi antenna, which is something you just mentioned. I'm seeing a diagram of something called a Marconi antenna, and the first diagram I'm looking at looks like a quarter-wave ground plane. What kind of an antenna did you use on these frequencies, Lou? And what makes you think that the voltage on the antenna was super high when you're only running 1 watt? By modeling programs and whatever, we could find out exactly what voltage is on every portion of that antenna. So what did you use as an antenna? And with 1 watt, what made you think that the voltage is real high? If the antenna has got a resistive component of 1 ohm, at least at the feed point, the voltage is quite low. Somewhere else on the antenna, the voltage may be pretty high. Over to you, Lou. And by the way, as long as you hear the four beeps, you can then start talking back to us. You don't have to wait for the whole identifier. Over to you, Lou.
Oh, okay. Look, we got it now. I had a, this was, 20, 30 years ago. I had a transmitter, that little transmitter that I made for about 185 KC, and it had a 5763 in it, so it's more than 1 watt, but I didn't really put it on the air. I had it tied into a 20 or 30 feet of wire in the house just to watch what would happen, and a loading coil, a big loading coil that I had here, and I mean, I could just see the I had neon bulbs lighting up half a foot away. I could just see how much voltage there was on there when I tuned it up right. So that was as far as I ever got with it. I never put it on the air. First place, it violated the rules because it was a little too powerful, so I didn't do it. But it was just an experiment. It was an old VFO that I took some toroids and converted it into a low-frequency transmitter. I had a crystal for it. I think I originally was using a BC-221 as a VFO. Go ahead, Dick.
Comment. How many watts were you putting into that when you were lighting up a neon bulb?
Oh, 5763 is about 5 or 10 watts, I guess.
I'll go ahead with your comment, Wesley.
Andrews here. The Amateur Radio Research and Development Corporation, AMRAD, has got a license in 1999 for 1 year for using the 136.75, but also in regards to the antenna, I found that AMRAD has built an radioactive antenna project, and it is in QST September 2001. The antenna looks pretty small. What I see in here is about 20 inches long. That's all.